Part 2. Very Old Bones. Pleistocene Wars. So various were the peoples of the Americas that continent-wide generalizations are risky to the point of folly. Nonetheless, one can say that for the most part, the initial Indian-European encounter was less of an intellectual shock to Indians than to Europeans. Indians were surprised when strange-looking people appeared on their shores, but unlike Europeans, they were not surprised to learn that such strange people existed. Many natives, seeking to categorize the newcomers, were open to the possibility that they might belong to the realm of the supernatural. They often approached visitors as if they might be deities, possibly calculating, in the spirit of Pascal's wager, that the downside of an erroneous attribution of celestial power was minimal. The Taino Indians, Columbus reported after his first voyage, firmly believed that I, with my ships and men, came from the heavens. Wherever I went, they ran from house to house and to the towns around, crying out, "Come, come, and see the men from the heavens." On Columbus's later voyages, his crew happily accepted godhood, until the Taino began empirically testing their divinity by forcing their heads underwater for long periods, to see if the Spanish were, as gods should be, immortal. Moctezuma, according to many scholarly texts, believed that Cortez was the god-hero Quetzalcoatl, returning home in fulfillment of a prophecy. What historian Barbara Tuchman called the emperor's wooden-headedness in a special variety of religious mania is often said to be why he didn't order his army to wipe out the Spaniards immediately. But the anthropologist Matthew Restall has noted that none of the conquistador's writings mention this supposed apotheosis, not even Cortez's lengthy memos to the Spanish king, which go into detail about every other wonderful thing he did. Instead, the Quetzalcoatl story first appears decades later. True, the Mexica apparently did call the Spaniards Teteo, a term referring both to gods and to powerful, privileged people. The ambiguity captures the indigenous attitude toward the hairy, oddly dressed strangers on their shores. Recognition that their presence was important, plus a willingness to believe that such unusual people might have qualities unlike those of ordinary men and women. Similarly, groups like the Wampanoag, Narragansett, and Haudenosaunee in eastern North America also thought at first that Europeans might have supernatural qualities. But this was because Indians north and south regarded Europeans as human beings exactly like themselves. In their view of the world, certain men and women, given the right circumstances, could wield more than human powers. If the Wampanoag and Mexica had shamans who could magically inflict sickness, why couldn't the British? The Europeans, who themselves believed that witches could magically spread disease, were hardly going to argue. As a rule, Indians were theologically prepared for the existence of Europeans. In Choctaw lore, for example, the Creator breathed life into not one, but many primeval pairs of human beings scattered all over the earth. It could not have been terribly surprising to Choctaw thinkers that the descendants of one pair should show up in the territory of another. Contact with Indians caused Europeans considerably more consternation. Columbus went to his grave convinced that he had landed on the shores of Asia, near India. The inhabitants of this previously unseen land were therefore Asians, hence the unfortunate name Indians. As his successors discovered that the Americas were not part of Asia, Indians became a dire anthropogonical problem. According to Genesis, all human beings and animals perished in the flood except those on Noah's Ark, which landed upon the mountains of Ararat, thought to be in eastern Turkey.